Hello and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 17th of March 2013. My name's TRP Watson, and this week I'm joined by Phil from the West End Whingers, Web Cowgirl, Julie Raby, and Gareth James. We're now going to talk about The Winslow Boy, which is a new production at the Old Vic. This play by Terence Rattigan is directed by Lindsay Posner and stars Henry Goodman, Deborah Finlay, Naomi Frederick, and Peter Sullivan. This play is based on a real case of a young Osborne College naval cadet who allegedly stole a postal order from a fellow student and cashed it. And Terence Rattigan sort of takes on this idea, this real story, and sets it slightly later than it happened. I think it originally happened in sort of 1909. He sets it 1913 so he can get a bit of war references in. And he changes it about a bit, puts in a possible romance between, he sort of invents a suffragette sister who is sort of the conscience of the play in many ways, and makes the relationship between her and the barrister makes that relationship much more central and much more interesting. This production hasn't been in the West End, I don't think, for an absolute age. I think it might have been done elsewhere, places like the Theatre Clearwood and Lace Theatre, I think I've seen in the Wikipedia article, but it hasn't been on stage here for years. There have been a couple of well-known films and a TV adaptation. There was a 1948 film which starred Robert Donat and Margaret Leighton as the barrister and the sister. Then there was a 1999 production done by David Mamet, which had Rebecca Pidgeon and Jeremy Northam as the two people. I should have, of course, mentioned the other major character in the play is the father, which in this case that would be Cedric Hardwicke and Nigel Hawthorne, who I should be mentioning. The BBC also did an adaptation of the play which starred Ian Richardson and Emma Thompson in 1990, I think. So, you know, it's been around, and it's quite, you know, something that you would have seen, but not on stage recently. And what I found actually quite refreshing about this production on stage was how funny it is. I mean, it seemed very dry and rather dull, seeing it on television or in the theatre, in cinema. But on stage, you get the witty lines, but you also get the laughter, and there's quite a lot of sort of, you know, general comedy. The actual story is fairly serious, but but there's a lot of sort of comedy that goes in around it, and you get the comedy, and you're able to enjoy it a lot more in this. One of the differences, I think, here, which is from the films, another difference is that I found the films a little bit sentimental. It's all set up from the very start that when you have people like Robert Donat and Jeremy Northam, they're, you know, good looking, they're kindly, they come across as very kindly in the films, and, you know, it's pretty obvious that the daughter's going to fall for them. In this, Peter Sullivan is exactly as described. He is a cold fish, and he is extremely, you know, rigorous and strict and unpleasant, and you can't imagine initially that they could ever form a relationship or ever sort of begin to like each other. And it makes that transformation, that change between them, all the more powerful in this production. And I thought it was really well done. Phil, what did you think about
that? Absolutely really well done. I'd always wanted to see The Winslow Boy. I only know it from I think it's the 1948 film, which I remember mainly because there's a wonderful scene, which I won't say too much about because it would give away how it ends, with Kathleen Harrison, who plays the maid in it, where she has this sort of speech towards the end, which when I'm a bit drunk, I do an impersonation of it, because I know it quite well. So I sort of knew how it was going to play out ultimately. But in a way, that doesn't matter because, as you say, it's remarkably funny. There's some really great, as you say, dry lines in it. And it was getting the humour across very well. I thought the performances were absolutely top-notch throughout. Henry Goodman was really nicely understated in his role, and I thought Peter Sullivan's the QC was absolutely splendid. But they all were. I think Charlie Rowe, who plays the boy, who I was quite surprised to find that he's only 16, although he's playing a 14-year-old, an incredibly assured performance. I think he's going to be somebody to watch. Deborah Finlay was really rather terrific, very sensitive, sort of a very likable mother. I mean, what's I think, quite interesting is that the family is a very close family, and that really comes across. You really feel that the people, they sort of love each other, despite all the things that are going on and the things they have to deal with family hardships, because they've hired, you know, probably the most expensive lawyer in the country to try and clear Ronnie's name. And their sort of connections and warmth, I felt, really came across. It's really entertaining. It's quite long, but it's, funny enough, it didn't really feel like it. I think it's about 2 hours 50 minutes, but that's because it's sort of, you know, quite an old play. It's a very solid, well crafted piece, and I think Lindsay Posner, who's a really reliable director, has really got it together very well. But the first 10-15 minutes, I was thinking, well, this is a little bit creaky, but I think it just needed a bit of warming up, and it was quite an early preview. It's going to get even better, but actually it didn't really need to, because I had a great time. I thoroughly enjoyed it and would thoroughly recommend it.
Yeah, I did have a slight sort of sensation of somebody walking over my grave when I realised that the person who the barrister is based on is Sir Edward Carson, and in the play they mention, because they've moved it closer to the outbreak of the First World War, in fact it sort of ends about 3 weeks before, I think it ends about a month before the Archduke gets assassinated, but one of the things is that they mention in there that there's civil war being fomented in Ireland at the time, and this is, you know, this is real, and it did happen, and it was looking like, you know, there was, if the Germans hadn't started, you know, if the Germans didn't necessarily start the First World War, but if, you know, the Germans hadn't sort of invaded Belgium, there would have been quite possibly a very vicious civil war in Ireland. And one of the people fomenting that was a certain Edward Carson, who was the barrister in the original real-life case of this Osborne student, Archer Shea. So I just thought, this is because I'm a bit of a history nerd and I get things like that, and it was just a rather an odd thing to say, because Edward Carson would have been a fascinating person to do, you know, he's a fascinating person possibly to do a play about, but I don't think it's not really like him, and I'm not sure you'd be quite so nice about him if you knew what he got up to, although he's a massive hero in Northern Ireland, of course, to many unionists there.
Well, all that went all over my head completely. I actually wasn't even certain until, I think I said to you at the end, because you happened to be there the same night, that it was, I didn't realise it was based on a true incident. If I knew that, I'd forgotten it, which I think makes it more interesting. But also, actually, the other thing that struck me is, and I'm sure when it opens, the critics are going to pick up on this, is that the parallels with today and sort of big sort of cause célèbre trials, which are sort of played out in the public eye, the fact that this was a sort of quite a sensation in its day, and you get the feeling of that, although it's sort of mainly talked about, you know, they're being doorstepped by journalists, and you know, it's in the papers, and it, you know, this rumbles on for 2 years, and you can't help but make comparisons with sort of recent sort of trials, and you think, well, you know, I think there's probably one particular one, the Price Hume one, is somebody's going to make a play about that, because it's an interesting subject, although I don't think we'll have much sympathy for the characters in that. And also about sort of human rights issues, which they're very struck on, and the father, Arthur Winslow's, he just is seeking justice, and it's about him, you know, believing in his son's innocence, which of course we can't say which way it goes. And even though we don't see the scenes, you know, we don't see the trial, there is a sort of a mock trial played out in the living room beforehand. There's a slight one with Henry Goodman and the son initially, and a longer one when the QC questions the boy. So despite the fact it's sort of quite a lot of tell and not show, they do manage very cleverly to put that into the play. I think Rattigan did a really great job with this. It's a fantastically entertaining play.
We're now going to talk about Peter and Alice, which is the second play in Michael Grandage's company season at the Noel Coward Theatre. This tells the story of Alice Little Hargreaves, who met Peter Llewellyn Davis at the opening of a Lewis Carroll exhibition in 1932. Now, the interesting thing about those two people are Alice Little was the model for Alice and Alice in Wonderland, and Peter Llewellyn Davis was the model for Peter Pan, or one of the Lost Boys in Joan Barry's Peter Pan. So this is this encounter should provide, hopefully, in theory, should provide for some rather interesting ideas, and especially as we've got Judi Dench as Alice Liddell and Ben Whishaw as Peter Llewellyn Davis. This subject has partially been addressed before. There was a film written by Dennis Potter called Dream Child, which featured Alice Liddell in her older life when she visited New York and was rather shocked at the way they were treating all the characters in Alice in Wonderland. And it had Muppets, Jim Henson created creatures to play out some of the characters from the play, which happened in her dreams. And it also had Ian Holm as Lewis Carroll in that, which was rather interesting. This, in addition to Judi Dench and Ben Whishaw, we also have the likes of Ruby Bentall and Nicholas Farrell in this play. I think Ruby Bentall plays the younger Alice. Julie, what did you think about this production, and tell us more?
Yeah, I actually quite enjoyed it because I just found it quite interesting the way that they tell this story, because you kind of started off and you thought, oh, this is kind of a quite stuffy world that you're in. And then the set starts to reveal bits of the story, and you get these two younger actors playing the younger selves of Peter and Alice, which I thought was really fascinating. So it all starts off and it's not what it seems, and then things start to unravel and the past starts to unravel, and you get bit by bit of the lives of these two people, and I didn't know anything about them, so I felt I learned quite a lot about it. What I thought was really interesting was that I was sat right at the front, so I was straining a little bit because I was really, really close. But I felt that the proscenium arch set worked really well, in the sense of lots of layers going back and the sense of the storybook worlds that these real people, their childhood selves have been characters in this kind of storybook world. I thought it was quite interesting as well to have the authors on stage. So Nicholas Farrell as Charles Dickens, and we had J.M. Barrie on stage, and the kind of sense of those two characters taking over the parent roles for these two children, and slight obsessiveness around that as well, that kind of taking over and suppressing adulthood, that was a theme that kept coming through the play quite a lot, that their adulthood had been so kind of involved with these two authors as well in the relationships they'd had as children. So I found it quite interesting. I can see that people found it slightly dull. I've read a few reviews that people found it quite dull. I thought it worked doing it straight through as well. So it kept the momentum going, and it wasn't it wasn't long for me. I felt that worked really well.
It is only 75 minutes, isn't it? Yeah. So it's sort of, I think one or two people have said it costs more, it's sort of a pound per minute in some seats, which is a bit annoying.
Oh,
if you're counting the pennies. But
yeah.
There you go. The Web Cowgirl, what did you think about this?
I'm kind of wondering when that momentum ever happened, because I kept waiting for something to really occur that would suck me into the show. And about the most exciting moment in the whole play was when they actually revealed the set behind the bookshop. And it was really, a really gorgeous set. But for me to get excited about stagecraft is definitely my version of damning with faint praise, because I was unable to get into the lives or the characters of Alice or Peter at all, which is depressing. I'm a huge Alice in Wonderland fan, but there's no denying that the backstory of Alice's relationship with, well, refer to him by his pen name, with Lewis Carroll was, you know, a little questionable. And in the cases of both of the characters, there's been questions of pedophilia in terms of the relationships. And certainly the scenes where Alice is perhaps, shall we say, being groomed are very, very tense. But the playwright just ultimately just sort of sidles away from that. And I mean, I suppose there's, you know, there's nothing to be, that can't be proven anyway, but we get to the part where things could have gotten really, really gritty. And then we didn't go there. So for me, the emotional highlight of the play was Peter recounting the story of his youngest brother, who was supposed to be the actual inspiration for Peter Pan, and how essentially, as told in the play, J.M. Barrie's rejection of him and his homosexuality is what winds up leading him to kill himself. And I just feel like the author didn't have enough story, the playwright didn't have enough story to tell. So he had to kind of keep accreting things to the central focus of the two characters. And by adding all this stuff on, he made it rambling rather than nice and tidy like you'd expect out of a short play like that. And what's a shame is I felt like I was there for 2 hours, and I found myself looking at the set to look at interesting bits and thinking about it, because on one of the little pieces there's a character from Peter Pan and a character from Alice in Wonderland. I was like, ooh, that's a really nice juxtaposition, but I should never be looking at the set for entertainment. That's poor. So, you know, while I thought my £10 were reasonably enough spent, I thought it was a huge opportunity wasted. I think Judy and Ben, you know, my two pals, were definitely doing their best to bring the characters to life. I just don't think they had much to work with. And I just feel sad, because they had an opportunity to do something really great. This is the one original play that Grandage is doing for this season, and I'm glad it's, you know, selling out and it's being very popular, because then hopefully they'll do it next year. But they've really got to make more of an effort. I would say, if you actually like good theater, that while you might get £10 out of it, you won't really get 75 minutes out of it. So if you were sitting there debating over whether or not it was worth £65 to go see this play, say, I would say you can feel just completely fine that you did not get a ticket and spend that money seeing something more worthy.
Well, I was thinking that thing about telling. I felt that maybe the reason that it doesn't work for some people is that I think he's trying to show and leave you to work out the other things. And I suppose that, so it does kind of flip from one thing to another quite quickly without going into the depth.
Yeah, I'd agree with that, which is a shame. I wonder if he was actually limited by how long of a play, like if they had requested that it be a one-act play.
Yeah.
And that maybe if he'd had, you know, 2.5 hours, he could have really gone somewhere. I was really hoping that this play might be done as an exposure of the corrupting influence of celebrity culture or something like that, which would doubly play upon the, you know, high-level celebrity casting of the two leads. But it didn't really happen.
Yeah, that's an interesting idea, because I think, I mean, Ben Whishart's a quiet actor, isn't he?
Mm. He's very good.
Yeah, and I mean, there were people around me really emotional. There was somebody near me in tears at the end. So it clearly moved people. And I think that's it. He's kind of really understated as an actor. So I think it's kind of, you're watching it, trying to work out and think about it rather than it being kind of told to you. So I can see what you mean.
Sometimes I wonder, though, if my stoniness has a lot to do with how often I go to the theatre, because I find that people who don't go out very much will often be much more profoundly moved by a show than I am.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and certainly just if you catch me on a bad night, I can't enjoy a show, you know, for all the world. But, you know, perhaps for people who only go to the theater once or twice a year, this might be, you know, perhaps it'd be really enjoyable for them. And I can't, you know, I can't deny that there's definitely people who are enjoying the show. And I don't think they're saying they enjoy it because they felt like they're obliged to because of how much they spent for tickets or how good the actors are. I really think that they really enjoyed it. But I wish I could get behind them on that.
Yeah, I think that point you're making about celebrities is really, really interesting. And that point about people who kind of are maybe not going all the time, the sense of an occasion.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt that the waiting for, I mean, we waited about 8 minutes after that for them to come on. And that sense of the set revealing, is there something about an occasion in that moment as well? So maybe that's one of the things people are connecting to, the real sense of being in a theatre.
I think that's definitely a possibility. Mm. So, you know, for maybe for people who are experiencing, you know, like a special occasion by being enticed into the theatre, that this is working for them. I have to say I'm really happy that Grandage threw his efforts behind encouraging people to come see a new play by casting it in this way, because that makes me really happy, because you can't keep theater alive if you're just reviving, you know, like tried and true plays over and over again. And most of this season is there's actually not too much safety to this season. But just, I mean, how many Hamlets do we need to see in a year, really? And he's taken two people who could have sold out anything and used them to entice a new audience to come see a new play. And ultimately, you know, I think he's done a really good thing for London theatre by, you know, setting this up. Maybe the play, you know, for me, the play wasn't as successful, but if new audiences are coming in to the theater that might not have come for like a year or two, but couldn't resist seeing, what is it, M and Q on stage together, then I have to say I'm pleased with him for doing that.
Yeah.
There is a thing that, I mean, my personal theory about one of the reasons behind the high ticket prices in the West End at the moment is that they're not really aiming at regular theatre goers. They are aiming at people, like you say, who make a special, you know, it's a special event theatre. So it's people who might go once or twice a year rather than people who might go once or twice a month. And of course there are freaks like me who go sort of 16 or 20 times a month. But it's not for people like me. It's for the people who go once or twice a year, or, you know, when it's a special occasion, they're going, you know, it's a big night out there, and they want the sort of them to spend a large amount of money, both in buying the tickets, going to get a decent meal, but perhaps staying in a hotel, you know. So it's an all big package that they're going in for, and I think that's one of the things that the West End's kind of aiming for. And as annoyed as I am, if it gets people interested in the theatre, then the theatre will continue to live. I just, you know, I don't particularly like the fact that I can't afford to go to, you know, sit in a really decent seat. I think when I'm seeing Peter and Alice, I'm going to be up in the gods. But, you know,
they're quite a good seat anyway. Because I was up in the gods for Privates on Parade, and I was actually surprised how good it was. I didn't feel like I was miles and miles away.
Nor did I. I was up there too.
That theater is actually pretty good all the way to the top. It's not like the Palace where they've got like, I don't know, like a 25th balcony, where not only do you have your knees up to your chin, but the floor is not even level. And you can only see about a third of the stage, but I think any of the cheapest seats at the Noel Coward would still deliver good value.
Yeah, but I think that thing's really interesting about ticket prices, because you kind of can go to some things, you know, take a risk, But when you're paying that kind of money for the stall seats, you're thinking you do want to see something that you are going to enjoy. And I noticed the Richard II prices, the RSC, they're £55. So they're hitting West End prices to see, you know, the RSC. And usually you could get better seats at a lot cheaper price.
Yeah, I on the other hand, it's the shows that they can get the higher ticket prices for, I think, kind of help subsidize the ones that go for cheap.
Yeah.
So, you know, it all sort of feeds back into the theater ecology here.
Yeah.
But I don't know. It's a profit making business, be sure. But I do think it operates on thinner margins here than it does, say, in the U.S., mm-hmm. which makes it impossible for them to be more experimental and for smaller theaters to get by, and makes it possible for me and Tim to see five shows a week.
We're now going to talk about Miss Julie, which is a version of Miss Julie, August Strindberg's Miss Julie, which is written and directed by Yael Farber. This is a production set in South Africa, about 18 years after the end of apartheid. It's been quite a hit. I think it comes from it produced in association with the South African State Theatre, and was also in Edinburgh last year, and was a massive hit. And judging by some of the reviews on the website, it's getting 5-star reviews. It is probably a massive hit again. I have a slight problem with Miss Julie in that, you know, if I die never seeing another production of Miss Julie, I will die happy. I really don't like this play at all. There's just something about it. And I have to say, although I can see why they would do this, I mean, it's this particular idea because of the ideas of this sort of servant-mistress situation that they have, it's fascinating to see it done as a, you know, in South Africa with all the echoes of apartheid in it. But I just, you know, I don't really want to see this. Now, Web Cowgirl, why am I wrong?
Well, I have to say, I can kind of feel it a little bit, because I went and saw Miss Julie at the Young Vic, I guess it was last year, and it just seemed like such a dated old chestnut. I mean, you know, every now and then, what's another play? It's like Taming of the Shrew. You see something that so strongly reflects, you know, concerns and attitudes at a time a play is written that just don't even seem to make any sense anymore. You know, you're like, where's like the universal themes here? And for me, especially since I'm an American, this whole concept of, you know, the class system, and people actually believing that they're truly superior to somebody because of who their parents were, I can't understand it at all. I don't get it at a bone deep level. And for someone to also buy into a concept of their inferiority based upon, you know, the work that their parents did, you know, in Miss Julie, the chauffeur believes he's inferior to her. And so he watches her from a distance. She believes that she is superior to him, and that gives her the right to treat him a certain way because of who he is. And, you know, when you think about this as being about the class system and about, you know, to me, the class system is caught up on, you know, people's occupations, you know, as well as the wealth. I couldn't empathize with either the characters. I couldn't empathize with the chauffeur putting up with it. I couldn't empathize with her and her attitude about herself. So I could see how you could see that play and just hate it because of the two characters, the two lead characters. But I read a preview of this, I think, in The Guardian, where, you know, it finally became clear to me that this wasn't just a different racial casting, because if you just take the chauffeur and make him some, you know, black English dude, and then she's some white English rich girl, and I thought it was, I saw the pictures, and I thought it was just some kind of stunt casting to make it more juicy or something, salubrious, just, and I thought, you know, gosh, how how tacky of them, you know, to try to tap into the, you know, the white fear of white women sleeping with people who aren't white, you know, because this is, you know, in America, our problem isn't class, it's race. And this is apparently a problem for a lot of people there. But what, I mean, so I thought they were trying to do that just to be, be more controversial. But then when I saw it being set in South Africa, suddenly a lot of the problems I had with the plot all fell into place. And it's not set in South Africa in the 1970s. It's set in now. And suddenly this play has become relevant and it matters because we're looking at a society where the concepts of your power relationship based upon who your parents are goes back for 200 years and is still being fought over today. And the society there is so turbulent and so much change is going on, and it can be very, very violent. And that takes all of the playing and fun, which is kind of a disgusting way to refer to it, of Miss Julie with her father's servant, and really cranks it up into a, well, you know, it might have been okay for her to see John as, you know, simply, I think that she called him a kefir boy, an ignorant nobody, someone that could be ignored, a nothing. Like, when she was little, maybe that was okay, but he knows as well as she does that that's not how things are anymore. Things have changed. And by the end of this play, you can see he does not buy into that subservience anymore. He knows he is, in many ways, not just her equal. He is better than her, better than who she is. And she knows that, in fact, she has, you know, no hold over him. She doesn't have this society that'll just like wait, you know, right behind her and absolutely be supporting her. In fact, she's in danger of losing everything. And so the situation is so much more heightened than, you know, it is when it's set in the 1880s, or was it the 1890s. But I loved the way that this play became alive and relevant in this setting. The two leads are Bongile Mantsai as John and Hilda Kronje as Julie. Dealing with each other are electric, and the sex scenes between them are extremely graphic, while not crossing into the X-rated line, but just you can feel like the energy and also the emotion that their characters take into it, absolutely electric, just like sticking your finger into a light socket. And I think that if you don't go see this show because you hate the play Miss Julie, that you are going to be missing out on an opportunity to see a visual, visceral depiction of the conflicts in an extremely torn and very fraught country, done with some occasionally beautiful and occasionally horrifying language. And it does not stick to, you know, the original play. It takes time to develop new and different characters. As this play was performed, I feel that Julie's inner mental instability isn't really as strong as it is in the play, because as the original version, because as I see it, in the second half of this play, Julie's mental messed upness becomes much more forward. And the way Hilda played her, she doesn't come off as fragile. And I prefer being able to end the play with a little bit of empathy for her. And I have to say, in Mees Julie, at the end of the play, you don't like her any more than you did at the beginning because she's really just a piece of work. But I think you will talk about this play for years, and if you don't go see it, you're going to kick yourself.
Yeah, I had a horrible feeling that it was going to be something like that, I have to say. I looking at all the reviews, I just thought, no, that yes, it's going to be something like that. I'm going to have to grip my teeth and have to see this play. It's a
distressing. Oh, I see. Well, you know, I was able to get 20-pound tickets, and you know what? It's like, it's longer than Peter and Alice, and it feels like it's about half as long as Peter and Alice was. And I'm like, it's 90 minutes. You walk out of it, your hair is standing on end. You want to hold on to puppies and kittens and try to console yourself that life actually isn't quite as shitty as all that. And you just go, wow. And all this time, I just thought Strindberg was so ridiculously caught up in his own time that people only like this play because there's a foot fetish scene in it and, you know, they want to get their kicks. I never thought this play could be updated and make a bit of difference. And I'm almost embarrassed to say that the reviews are quite correct about how good it is. Oh, and the good news is because it's so short, you can make it back from Riverside and it's not too late. So you just go out there, bang, 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 and you know, you make it back home. And the Sunday show's at 6 o'clock, and that just works out perfectly. So I'm glad I decided to give Miss Julie another chance. So. I'm sorry if this is going to make life difficult for you. I was never going to see Taming of the Shrew again, but now the Propeller's doing it. I'm making myself go see it. So, you know, sometimes we just have to punish ourselves that way. But then if you come out and you go, wow, this has completely changed how I feel about this, then it was all worth it. And then you'll definitely never have to see Miss Julie again, right? So you get like, you know, you'll get decades cleared for making this one effort.
So, Gareth, what did you think about this production? Because Webcam Girls almost persuaded me.
Well, if she can't persuade you on her own, then I'm going to add to the persuasion big time. I missed this in Edinburgh because it was a huge hit and sold out quite fast. So I was thrilled when they announced it was coming to London and booked zonks ago to go and see it, to be sure I could get to see it. I think it's just terrific. Well, terrific is the wrong word because that sounds, words like enjoyment and terrific are probably all wrong here, because it's actually very harrowing and a very difficult thing to sit through. But it is very rewarding. I mean, it is, you know, very raw, very dramatic. You'd be struggling to see anything quite as dramatic as this anywhere, really. It's a very faithful adaptation, except that they've, for some reason, I'm not sure I understand, changed the servants to mother and son, which I think are fiancés in the original, but it works perfectly well. Other than that, it's it's just a change of setting, really. It's a South African farm instead of a Swedish nobility estate. She's the daughter of a wealthy farmer rather than the noble's daughter. So, you know, in all other respects, it's very faithful to it. It's got an incredible brooding atmosphere, part of which comes from a soundscape created live at the side of the stage by a couple of musicians, which really does give it a kind of an incredible, intense and brooding atmosphere. And it's very explicit. So the things that Strindberg would never put on a stage are absolutely on a stage. You know, things that are off stage normally in Strindberg are absolutely in your face here. And that can be quite difficult. The performances are just stunning. The two actors of the play, John and Miss Julie, are just amazing. I mean, Bongile Mantsai, who plays John, is a terrific actor. And Hilda Kronje, who plays Julie, is also terrific. And it's a very physical set of performances. You know, they kind of throw themselves around. And there are times when you have to, you know, you have to turn away. And there are times where you find it very difficult to watch. But, you know, it is a brilliant adaptation. It's superbly staged by Yael Farber, who also adapted it. And it just gets just some fabulous performances. I mean, I just think it's completely unmissable. You absolutely have to go and see it. Whatever you think of Miss Julie, you absolutely have to go and see this particular production. And I'm kind of with you on, you know, seeing enough Miss Julies in a way. So I kind of do understand that perspective, but you have to make an exception.
We're now going to talk about the Burnham Grove. Now, this is the Finbra's Monday and Sunday show that has been on recently. Unfortunately, it's probably closed by the time you're listening to this. The Burnham Grove is a second performed play by J.B. Priestley, and it's a sort of gentle comedy. It's about a rather staid man called George Redfern, who seems to be a decent, respectable man, prosperous line of business, paper distribution, which reminds you a little of The Office, and everybody sort of takes him for granted and bit sponges off him, really. People are looking for, you know, always looking for him to give them a few loans and things like that, and think he's rather a dull old stick. And he suddenly announces that he's actually a criminal mastermind of a kind, and it then goes on like that, and you're not entirely certain whether or not he's telling the truth, and you sort of get an idea towards the end of what the real business is. But it's quite a shock for all his hangers-on, which is mainly his sister-in-law and her husband and her his daughter's fiance. It's actually a remarkably enjoyable piece, I thought. We have an exceptionally good performance by Robert Goodale as Mr. George Redfern. He's not an actor I particularly like, because he usually has to play these sort of creepy people, but in this he's funny and avuncular, and I'm really charmed by this play, and I'm not sure how else to say it. What do you think about it, Gareth?
No, I think charming is a good word to use for it, really. You're right, it's Priestley's second play, so it's about 10 or 12 years before something like An Inspector Calls. And I think it's unusual, because it sort of lulls you into thinking it's a suburban comedy until you get this, you get this confession to the sister-in-law, brother-in-law, and the daughter, and the daughter's fiancé. And you don't really know, certainly at that point and for a while later, you don't really know whether he's joking or whether he's just manipulating or whether it's actually true. And that's quite clever. And I think that's probably where the actor who plays George, Robert Goodale, as you mentioned, is so good, because he retains that kind of deadpan that helps you, you know, that helps you live with that story for a while. I described it as an Ealing comedy. I left the theatre with that lovely warm feeling you have, you know, when it's a Sunday afternoon on the sofa and you're curled up watching Passport to Pimlico. There's something just charming and delightful about the whole thing. It is sort of gently funny. And the Finbra, like the Orange Tree, you know, does have a real knack in finding these early to mid 20th century plays that haven't been done, I think in this case, for 30 years. And then just giving them just lovely little performances. And here, you know, the casting is just amazing for me. I mean, the brother-in-law is a terrific Timothy Speyer. I mean, he's been out in the Far East and sort of in the colonies, and he comes back with a sort of pomposity talking about, you know, life out there. And his wife is the nag to end all nags, and Lynette Edwards plays that absolutely brilliantly. George's wife doesn't have much to do in the first half, Dorothy. She's played by Karen Asker, but actually really does come into her own. And at the end of the play, I think she's quite masterly, for reasons that you only realise when you see the play, I suppose. So I just thought it was a real gem, you know, great to find it rediscovered, given a lovely, lovely production. And I just smiled and kind of left the theatre thinking, you know, what a lovely evening. And they did it with London Wall. They did it with Mixed Marriage, although that was more tense rather than funny. So there are a lot of examples of the Finbra here. picking out a play like this and giving it a run. And what's amazing for me is that they've even persuaded Oberon to actually print the play, given it's only having about 6 or 8 performances to 50 people. They've actually persuaded Oberon to publish the play. So you can go and see it for £10 and buy a copy for another £3, which is just simply fantastic. So another lovely night at the Finborough. Really, really enjoyable.
And yet another reason for wanting Neil McPherson to move into a slightly bigger place.
Yeah.
Because, it wouldn't have been any less if you had 200 people in that audience, I don't think.
No.
I always find it such a shame when you go to these good things at the Finborough. It's just, you just want it somewhere, for more people to get to it, really.
Yeah, and because I like Priestley, I kind of take any opportunity to see a Priestley, really. And they first announced this way before the rest of this season. And I was kind of looking at the email I printed off to take with me to the theatre on Sunday, and I kind of booked it 6 months ago. And I'm told that, every ticket was sold quite a long time before the opening of the show. So I'm sure, there are so many more people who would love to see this. And it's just such a shame. Only a handful do, only about 400 do, really. But you're right, Neil McPherson must get a better space or more than one space because we're getting such fantastic work from this place.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the as-yet-unnamed London Theatre Podcast page in Facebook. On the web, we are ayu-londontheatre.org, and the podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you. Goodbye.